Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome everybody. Here District, I'm the captain of this vessel, Marcus Johnson, joined by my son, Chris Johnson, the only father and son combination in the history of NCAA basketball to win a national championship at the same school. And speaking of that school, UCLA, Chris representing the Bruins with that hat on. I'm representing the Dodgers. I think it's enough time has passed for my Milwaukee fan base to have gotten over
They're
that.
Still soft. They're still salty.
Still salty. All right, well, whatever. Anyway, so we've got a former Bruin man and one of my favorites just for a variety of different reasons, and we'll get more into that. But Earl Watson's a 13-year NBA veteran. He was a four-year starter at the UCLA basketball program. Didn't happen very often. He's been a coaching assistant in the Spurs organization with the Suns, head coach of the Phoenix Suns with the Raptors. Man, just a wealth of basketball knowledge. Currently a studio analyst and game color commentator for the Big Ten Network and FS1. Earl, man, welcome to Here District. We appreciate you coming on.
This is like UCLA royalty right here. To sit here with you two, Crenshaw's finest, right?
Ooh,
And I would love to know the stats of father-son duos' points in college. I bet you guys are up there dropping buckets on the regular.
Chris, did you ever look that up, Chris?
I did. We're in the top five, I think.
Top five.
You have Steve Burt Jr. They dropped a multitude of buckets.
Iona.
I think the Waltons, right. The Mays. So we're up there, though. I scored almost 1,300. MJ had over, what, 1,600, MJ? 17?
It's up somewhere in there. I forget.
Please.
The exact number, but yeah, man, I appreciate that. And so while we're on that subject of college basketball, this is my Earl Watson story, Chris. And you know this, Earl. You probably don't know this. And so Chris's senior year, Coach Wooden fell in love with Earl. Coach Wooden, just every time he was put in front of a daggone microphone, he was talking about how Earl Watson needs to be a starter. If I was coaching UCLA, Earl Watson would be my starter. This is how much of an impact that Earl Watson made on John Wooden. And so the odd man out at that point in time was going to be Chris. You know, just in terms of, you know, the guys that were available. And Chris was going to be and so I went to Lab, Earl, after practice. And I'm like, Lab, Chris is a senior. He's battled some adversity. He's back now. And you're talking about starting Earl over Chris. Earl's a daggone freshman. He's good and everything, but Chris is a senior. So Lav hits me up with, well, Coach Wooden says Earl should be a starter. Coach Wooden says Earl should be a starter. So my response to Lav was, well, Coach Wooden also says that you're not experienced enough to be the head coach at UCLA. Are you going to resign because Coach Wooden said you don't have the experience to be? Well, no, of course not. Don't tell me what Coach Wooden said. I don't want to hear nothing Coach Wooden got to say right now. But as things worked out, man, you guys started that season, man, and just for you. What was it about you think that impressed Coach Wooden so much? If you had to try and put a label on it,
First off, let me tell the backstory. One of the main reasons why I went to UCLA was because of Chris. Every time I would call, back in the day, you had to call the office, and then the coaches would be in the office and they'd pick up the phone. I always be like, "Where's Chris Johnson at? Where's Chris Johnson?" He was always in the office somehow with Herod. I don't know if he was getting in trouble or he was always in the office. So I was like,
"Hey,
Chris,
I hung out
on the phone."
In the office, man.
But Chris was so charismatic, man, on the phone. He made me feel like a brother immediately. Mm-hmm. And I'm back home in Kansas. Like, man, I got to get there. I want to play with Chris Johnson. Like, he's cold. He got footwork. His footwork is like impeccable. Like, he can score, he can shoot. I can't wait to get in pick and roll. I can't wait to find my assist going to go up. So I was just always a Chris Johnson fan. And then when it came to Coach Wooden, I really think, because I did the little things, right? Coach Wooden was, I mean, you know, Marcus, you know better than me, but I took it as Coach Wooden really valued the things that glued teams together, the things that were selfless, that didn't show up in the box score, rebounding, defending, making an extra pass, playing the right way, playing with effort. And if shots came to me, then I obviously took them. But my whole first year was about making everyone around me better and just being selfless.
For me personally, understanding what Earl brought to the table, it also was schematically, like, of course I wanted to start. Of course, you know, but I got in trouble along with Jelani. So, you know, it was sort of a timing thing. We had to re-earn the trust of our teammates and all of that. But also schematically, when you have Earl Watson and Baron Davis as a backcourt, two legitimate point guard, ball handler, defenders, guys that could create shots, guys that were straight up dogs. Like, I could see why Coach Wooden wanted that sort of look, you know, because it was a certain, it was going to be a certain style we were going to play. And to be quite frank, those guys were the best freshman backcourt in the country that season. And had already had an incredible chemistry. If you don't remember, MJ, Earl was throwing it off the glass in game.
I remember.
Off the backboard in game to BD on somebody's head. So I got all that. And the thing about it, Earl, you'll never know this, but like, even through that drama, like, usually I hold that against the person for the rest of their life. The fact that Coach Wooden would have wanted you to start, like, I would hold it against you for the rest of your life. Yeah. But Earl, dude, for some reason, maybe it's because you live with us over that summer when you first came to town, and I got to know you, and I really liked you a lot, bro. So it was like, I wasn't even tripping. I was like, I didn't have it on the inside, any type of feeling, you know. And then you repaid that, and I'm gonna keep talking. You repaid that, bro. You passed me the ball so much more than Baron Davis did that season. And I'll always thank you, and I'm always thankful for you for that, for looking for me on all those opportunities, my man. Thank you.
Hey, Marcus, I don't know if you noticed, but in June of '97, it was like the first week of June, like Christian was still in school. I moved to L.A. and I stayed with Baron for like a week, and I stayed with Chris and Jelani for like the rest of June till they got out of school. We was playing in the same on the same team together. So I was literally sleeping on the floor, right? So we had like this chemistry. I think they saw me like a real little brother, right? I'm literally from gym bag to gym bag, not having a lot of clothes, a lot of money, just wherever they went, I went, sleeping on the floor all of June in L.A. They're in class. I'm walking around, wandering around. Right, we're going to play at the Say No Classic, and that was my introduction to Los Angeles.
Yeah, and so a couple of things. Number one, I mean, Chris came home one day after practice and said that I think Toby had tried to pull the upperclassman senior thing on you, and you just like you went straight hood on him, like, hey, you know, I don't know what you was throwing, what you was throwing up, man.
Wacko,
was that what it was? Wacko, yeah, homie, Wacko, you know, whatever it was. And I heard, and he's like, Dad, but this dude, he's a different type of brother, man. Don't get it twisted. I was like, okay, just for a freshman.
And Marcus, you know who's from my hood that you guys would know well? Lucius Allen. Lucius Allen is from my hood. It's like this edge that we have, and that incident with Toby broke my heart, man. I was the biggest Toby Bailey fan. I wore my t-shirt under my jersey after seeing you guys win the championship. You guys beating Missouri, right? And I living in Kansas City, which is basically across the street from Missouri.
Oh, man.
So, like, it was so much. I'm like, Toby Bailey. And then Toby wanted that ball every possession. I'm like, hold up, Toby.
That's what it was about.
I got Chris over here giving 18 to 25. I got to share the wealth, right?
Yeah. And just quickly tell our fans and our listeners about Chris and what he was about that year, man. He averaged 18 a game, 41% from the 3-point line, 52% overall from the field. What was his game about, man? That as far as you can recollect,
it's two people I've ever seen in my life, and I'm not saying I'm the biggest basketball connoisseur or a master at all, but Kiki Vanderway and Chris Johnson. The way they play with the footwork and the pivots and the reverse pivots, like the awkward steps, the hezzies, the way they read in a box around them with the jab, they were the master of the jab just as much as Kyrie is a master as the handle and the bop. Because it's the same thing, right? It's the same momentum. It's the same energy. Just one bounces, one you lose is your balance. One you lose your balance, and the other you always keep it. And when Chris impacted me so much that when I got to Phoenix as a development coach and I was assigned to this young draft kid by the name of Devin Booker, the first thing we did was learn all of Chris's footwork. So if you watch early Devin Booker, and I used to put him in a post a lot, at the elbow, on the perimeter, he doesn't bounce it before he checks, right? He takes it, he jabs, he checks, we read, and then we master any, and we manipulate any mistake you make with your hips, with your shoulders, with your hands. Watch how Devin play. So I gave Devin Booker everything I learned from Chris. And what I learned early in my career at UCLA, just stepping foot on campus, is it's a wealth of knowledge, man. Like, I need to humble myself, watch everyone, learn from everyone, and understand their rhythms and how they play and why they play. Keep that for myself. And I never knew one day I would coach and give it to a kid who could be arguably the greatest son to ever play, Devin Booker.
Now, Devin Booker, without question. A couple of things on that. The one common denominator with Kiki Vandeweghe and Chris Johnson is yours truly. All right. So now Kiki was my workout partner from the time he's 15, 16, me and Malik. Remember Malik Abdul-Mansour? You know, so we work out every summer. Now, Kiki went to Pete News Big Man Camp and all that, but he had all that inside pivot stuff. That was our stuff. And Chris, that's kind of where Chris got it from. But that's the
100.
Stuff. That's the stuff. Jamal Wilkes was a real, real master at that. And so the inside pivot was our stuff. And then you mentioned Devin Booker. And Chris, I maybe never told you the story, but when Earl was an assistant at Phoenix working with Devin Booker, this young rookie out of Kentucky with loads of potential, but you didn't know what he was going to be at that moment. Didn't know he was going to be just a really, you know, he's going to be a good player, but you didn't know he's going to be this, you know, 25 plus point per game guy. But Earl, I was working, I forget with whom, and maybe the Bucks at that time early on. Yeah, probably the Bucks. And Earl was with Devin, and he said, you know, old school, come on over here, you know, drop some knowledge on a young fella. So he had me talk to Devin Booker, you know, and told him who I was and kind of what I represented in the terms of basketball. And I think I told Devin what Larry Brown told me, like the two most important summers of your career, the summer before your rookie year, the summer after. Summer after, you know what to work on, what to improve upon. And so, but I just so appreciated that Earl included me, you know, in that conversation and as a, not a mentor by any stretch of the imagination, but just giving some valuable insights to a young rookie, 19, 20 years old, who's trying to find his way in the league.
Marcus, that's kind of the UCLA way, right? We go to the men's gym, we find someone, we get mentored, we get a wealth of knowledge, we go home, we work on it, and then we give it back. So with Devin meeting you, that's an audit. I can't tell him how to be a Hall of Famer, right? I got to take him to the Hall of Famers. I can't tell him how to go out there and get 25. I got to take him to the people who can teach him how to get 25, but I can teach him how to have a motor. I can teach him how to have imagination. And as a coach, I can instill supreme confidence. But also as a coach, you got to know your limitations, and you learn like the kids learn when you listen to the stories of, like, you know, the Marcus Johnsons that give them. After I send Devin to talk to Kobe, after we played him, the only time Devin played against him in the locker room, you learn and you grow, and you just continue to put that into your bag as a teacher.
Earl, how did you deal with, like, just the development of Devin Booker? You had a belief in D-Book before pretty much the organization kind of believed in him. You knew what you saw. You knew what he could be. I'm just thinking about the current Bucks team with a kid like Ryan Rollins, Kevin Porter Jr., two young players that are on the cusp of kind of becoming and taking that next step. How did you kind of deal with that when you had D-Book, you had a young team, and you had sort of different agendas going on in that front office? How did that work out?
I always say, Chris, I'm a slow learner. But once I figure it out, I find a way to become unique at it and try to master it. Devin Booker, I got with him. And the first thing I do is I learn the person. I don't talk basketball. I learn the person because I want to check you here. I want to see what's there. And he had this unique maturity about him where he always stayed even keel. If you watch him in interviews, he doesn't change the tone of his voice. whether it's up or down, it's here. That's how he plays. Yep. But he also had this toughness about him. And I think I instilled a lot of that tough. You watch him and you watch my AAU teams, any of my teams play, we pretty confrontational. Like, we're going to try to meet you in the back if we got to. And I got that from Yubi Brown in Memphis in my days with Memphis and Jerry West and Yubi, right? So I instilled that in him. And then we talked about, and I thought about, how could you be effective? Because in Kentucky, he was a catch and shoot player, a one dribble pull up player. Well, right. He doesn't have the speed to put it on the ground and bop. So instill Chris Johnson and Kiki Vanderway footwork. Master the elbows, master the mid post, take that same footwork on the perimeter, right? And now how do you get back to those spots on the court, right? Two dribble pull-ups, right? Manipulate the pick and roll. If a player get on you, you don't need to put it on the ground and get into your handle because that ain't really what you do, but you can jab, 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 move the – I watched how you move the ball around, Chris, so you got into your shot pocket. So we teach all that, right? And now we manipulate. How many ways can we get to the elbow as an activation point, which Rollins do? He gets to that elbow. And he understand that's an activation point. And he might kill you at the rim. He might kill you beyond that arc. But he puts you to sleep at those elbows, right? So how can we get there? And how many different ways can we get there? How can we manipulate that? And if we can't get there off the bounce, I'm going to put you there on the catch. They don't do that anymore, right? I'm going to put you that elbow on the catch. Oh. Now, when you put someone at the elbow on the catch, where are you going to double from? You can't. Because I'm in an activation zone, that pass is too close to the strong elbow, to the weak side elbow. I'm one dribble away from the rim, and I might not need my dribbles if my footwork is right. With the jab, jab, shot fake, jab, hands down, man down, bop, right? Yeah. Shoulders, hips, eyes, neck.
Ball in shot pocket, ready.
All of that, all of that. Chin, the neck, up, down, right? I learned it all from Chris. I had to guard Chris in practice. Out of guard Chris, out of guard Baron, I'm about to steal everything, right? Yeah, so when you talk about that, Chris, and here's a pivotal moment that I think took off for Devin Booker. Because at first, Devin Booker had to beat out Sonny Weems. He had to beat out Archie Goodwin. He had to beat out Brandon Knight. And everyone thought I just had this personal relationship with him and I was biased, right? It's February 2017. Jimmy Butler's in Chicago with Hoiberg. We had just played them, maybe a week or two before. Jimmy and Hoiberg, Hoiberg is mild-tempered, mild-mannered, but Jimmy's going to Hoiberg in the middle of the game. Y'all know Jimmy. And I'm coaching the game, Chris. And somewhere, somehow, I'm thinking, oh, I really fuck with Jimmy. I could really do something with that dog. You need, if you got a team full of good people, you know what you have, Chris? Now, I ain't going to say good people. You have a team full of non-confrontational players. Do you know what you have as a coach? You have a losing team. Like, I can do something. Give me Jimmy and give me the Marcus Cousins and let me, you know, get in the mix with them. Because where I'm from, I can relate, right? They're going at it. So Jimmy, you know, gets on the block. We're on a road trip. We land. Sarver sends me a text. Come to my house immediately. It's like 2 or 3 in the morning. Maybe it was a 3-game road trip.
Robert Sarver?
Sarver, the owner of the Phoenix Suns. I'm not trying to go to nobody's house at 2 in the morning, bro. I'm trying to go home, right? I pull up to the house. It's Sarver. It's McDonough. And Ryan McDonough kind of gave me a look like, here we go. It's like, it goes some bullshit, right? So I sit down. I sit down and he goes, we have a trade. And I go, what's the trade? Because, you know, I'm first-year head coach. I'm always looking for us to get better. I'm now learning if you don't get better, you are obviously tanking, right? So I go, what's the trade? He go, we have a trade for Devin. We're going to send Devin to Chicago for Jimmy Butler. Chris, in that moment, I am the biggest Devin Booker advocate, right? Would have been a hell of a team, though.
Yeah.
Eric Bledsoe, Tyson Chandler, Brandon Knight, you know, Jimmy Butler. It could have changed my entire coaching trajectory, right?
But why? Moment, why didn't you? Though, why weren't you rolling? Yeah.
Man, I really seen a kid who could be one of the greatest players to ever play. And I sat there and I watched the kid work. I'm in the gym with the kid. I think coaches who don't get in the gym with their players, no matter what your position is as a coach, I think you lose imagination. You got to get on the court. You got to be in the workouts. You got to see what a player can actually do and cannot do. So when you get in the game and you draw up a play, you're confident in that play. Or you develop plays because you see something that you don't see in practice that you might see in an individual session, right? So in that moment, Chris, and this was the beginning of the end of me in Phoenix. In that moment, Chris, I say, if you trade Devin Booker, I am resigning tonight. So we go back and forth.
What?
We go back and forth. And right now, I feel sorry for Ronnie McDonough because he's like, the GM is like, oh, I'm like, I do not want to trade Devin Booker. You can build around him. I don't want to be the coach that traded potentially one of the best two guards, you know, say 5 to 10 to ever play. Yeah. I believe he had that potential. He had superstar potential. And it's one thing I learned from Coach Wooden. I never forget this from my talks with him. He said, belief is stronger than reality. If you have a player that makes our locker room believe, you have a chance. And Devin Booker is that type of player where he makes that locker room believe they have a chance to do something amazing. Baron Davis gave me that belief. Chris Johnson at the end of the game gave me that belief, right? Toby Bailey winning the championship gave me that belief, right? Ray Allen, Gary Payton gave me that belief. And then I was with a Memphis team that had a young Pau Gasol. I didn't really believe in that. But then when I got to a Ray Allen or a Dame Lillard, I believed in that. So you got to have a player to give you that. So I feel like I didn't want to do that. And in that moment, Sarver said, if we don't trade him, we're going to try to get the number one pick and your coaching record will be shot. And I just rolled with that. I just rolled with it.
So basically, y'all take it.
I'm 34, 35 years old, Chris. I'm thinking I got a lifetime to coach, but I also got a chance to change this kid's life, who I think is amazing and spectacular. And I want to have an imprint on this organization, whether I'm here or not, that forever I set them up to have a chance moving forward.
So Earl, quickly, just, and this is one of the questions I want to ask you, because, I mean, if anybody's cut out to be a coach, it's Earl Watson. And I'm not biased. I just know you. I've listened to you. I hear you talk about the game. You talk about it with that connectivity to players. Like you're saying, get on the court with the player, get a chance to know the player so you can expand the creative bounds that might be there. But is that what happened? Is that what happened in Phoenix? Just that, was that the beginning of the end for Earl Watson in that season? You tell me what went on beyond that point. To not have it work out in Phoenix like it should have worked out.
It triggered us after. How about this? A month later, Devin Booker goes into Boston and has 70. How about that?
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
So then, as a rookie,
no.
Hey, Marcus, if you watch that game where he has 70, I got criticized for that game. Like me and Brad Stevens are literally, I'm at center court. We cussing each other out. They thought it was disrespectful, right? I had 8 players available. 3 of them were G League. Who you think was going to get the ball, Chris? Every ATO, every position. Who'd you think was going to get the ball, right? Who'd you think, right? Please. So for me, we started something in Phoenix called, that summer, we called it Project Moon Landing 2020. We knew by 2020 we would get the number one pick. Now, I wasn't there for the number one pick, but they chose the wrong number one pick. I'd have been Luka Doncic slamming my hand on the table all day, right? I would have been like, you have to, because I always thought Devin needed another guard to grow with. So the end of me in Phoenix, which I don't know if I ever said
that. That was DeAndre Ayton, right?
So okay, I wasn't there long enough to get to that to 2020. So the ending for me, I got fired in training camp in Phoenix. I was told in 10 days. By Sarver, you're done, right? Either fire Rich Paul or get fired. And I didn't have a relationship with Rich Paul to even care to even make a decision. Rich told me what it was. I told Rich, I'm not going to fire you. Like, I'm not about to be used as a pawn because you two are arguing over an extension for Eric Bledsoe, which is Rich had a point. Rich was saying if you're not going to improve the team, extend my player early or else you're losing his you're declining his value.
Right.
And so that ended up backlashing at me because I was with Clutch. Right. And 10 days later, I got fired. The team knew I was getting fired. Sarver was vocal about it, as Sarver always is. But what a great experience for me. Right. Yeah. To really understand that side of the NBA basketball, have a chance to impact a player like Devin Booker, coach the game. You know, do you know how hard it is to coach in Boston? The number one defense at the time in the NBA, and you got to put up points. That your ATO game better be really good, right? Yeah. You got to draw plays with a depleted roster, and it was amazing for me to have those experiences. So what a great opportunity. So when you talk about what happened in Phoenix, that's what happened in Phoenix. Like, moving beyond that, I am never going to – and I got this from Pop because, you know, I started in the G League with San Antonio. I got this from Pop and RC, and if you tell me something, I'll take it literally. So don't tell me anything you don't mean. They told me in the beginning, Chris, this is a good one. If you're sitting in a room, right, and it's coaches, and it's front office, if you're sitting in a room and a topic comes up and everyone agrees, that means That means someone's lying. So in San Antonio, we had this thing called throw it on the board. You asked, why is San Antonio different? Because they value opinion. They value a different perspective. And we throw it on the board. We write everyone's opinion on the board. And we'll circle what we're going to commit to. It's a thing they call disagree but commit. So when we leave this room, we might have disagreed and had a cipher and debated. But when we leave, we all commit to what it is and we teach it. That's where I was taught to coach from. So if you get me in a room and you have a lot of coaches, and this is crazy, like being on the other side of coaching, we tell players all the time, no matter how much talent I bring on in this room, compete and get along. Share the ball. Well, in the coaching carousel, they don't coach that way. They don't want a lot of talent in a room. They want people that's going to make it okay for them to say, yeah, Chris, that's the way. That's how you do it. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't know if that's how you do it. Like, I don't really know if Pascal Siakam is upset at anyone in this room right now. Pascal is the type of player. Here's a crazy story for you, Chris. I'm with Todd Remizar. He represents Pascal, right? I'm not coaching in Phoenix, right? He goes, EJ, I need your help in Toronto. Pascal just had a year where he struggled. He was getting into it with Nick Nurse. Right. And now, you know, the front office of Toronto is panicking. He just had shoulder injury. Right. I think it's 2021. Mm. And I go, Todd, you know, me in the NBA room, I don't do too well because I see it differently. And when you see it differently, you're a threat. And the truth is, I'm just an artist at what I do. I don't care what my position is. Put me on the court. I don't care. He was like, EJ, I need you. Right. So I end up in Toronto. I don't have a relationship with Nurse. And it's kind of awkward. I don't care. I feel like when you come from UCLA, every room you walk into is awkward. They don't like you anyway, right? People hate UCLA. They hate UCLA. It is what it is, right? It is what it is. Like, you know, educated and, you know, whatever. So Pascal, we get in the gym. Pascal is a very unique person. You gotta approach people differently. Marcus, you'll like this one. So guess where we start at, Chris? The first drill.
What?
Come on, man. What's my base? What's my base, Chris?
Footwork, jab step, catch your elbow,
footwork.
Jab.
Footwork. Footwork, dog.
Footwork. Reverse pivots, mastering your footwork and your angles. So then, you know, after we continue to talk, I mean, I gotta find this kid, man. I gotta find how to get him rocking. Right? Because I could feel the disconnect between, you know, his surgery, going through a lot. They didn't make the playoffs. They had a championship. So much pressure. How can I bring back his rhythm? Basketball's all rhythm. If you don't have no peace with your rhythm, you're going to struggle. So guess what I found out, Chris?
What?
I found out he loves to play the piano.
Wow.
So when I learned he loved to play the piano, sometimes we would never watch film. He would be in the lobby playing the piano, and we'd just be talking. And then we would talk about life, we'd talk about basketball, watch no film, right? And then we go out there, and he just does his thing. So you got to reach people differently. It ain't always basketball, right? You got to find out who they are, what they are, how they like to play. And then as a point guard managing personalities, I know Chris is sacrificing for the team. I'm going to make sure that when I start over him, I'm going to make sure he gets the most field goal attempts. Because I want to keep the harmony of him and the team moving forward. And if I got to shoot less and take more charges and offensive rebound and do the things that don't show up in the box score for us to win, so be it. And I coach the same way.
How important, Earl, are those dynamics that you're talking about for coaches in today's NBA, managing shots, being able to get through to guys outside of basketball? How important is that for today's generation of NBA ball player?
And Earl, also to tag on to that, the differences that you see with today's player versus 20 years ago, if any.
Well, this is a good one. Hubie Brown told me they never made new people. They started making new coaches.
Woo!
I always say that. I always say it's on the coaches. But go ahead, Earl.
It's on the coaches, right? And what I learned in being in the NBA locker room, which you don't have in college, and you might start having, is NBA coaches are afraid to tell players the truth. They would rather lie to you to get you to like them than to tell you the truth and have conflict. But I was raised by a bunch of OGs in the game, right? Hubie Brown, Jerry Sloan, Ron Adams, George Karl, Doug Moe, right? Nate McMillan, Dwayne Casey, Frank Vogel, Jim O'Brien, right? The list can go on. Those are all the coaches I played for. I sought out the confrontation, but first I had to build that relationship. So, you know, if I come to you, it's because out of place of love, not a place of disrespect. So that's how the game has changed. Thanks. And then you talk about teaching the game, right? We have this thing called conceptual basketball where they're just out there hooping with space. But even hooping with space, you got to have rhythm. You got to have purpose. You got to have intent. You got to have a trigger that creates a cause and effect of your offensive flow. But at the end of the game, which I don't like about this basketball, which I say is a challenge, is the ball cannot end up in Earl Watson's hands with the shot clock going down. So how do we get it back to our main guy with 8 seconds or less? Because today basketball can end up with anyone, right? How do you keep your guy involved? Yeah. And then what Hubie Brown was great at, which I stole, if I got a Chris Johnson who doesn't get the same field goal attempts that he should because we're playing conceptual basketball, there's no sets, right? How can I get Chris Johnson shots that he knows he's going to get every game? How do you do that? ATOs, sight out of bounds. So Chris is averaging 15 shots a game, but in the Florida offense, Marcus, he's only getting 8. He knows he's going to make up the rest of that in every ATO and every side out. So now Chris knows, okay, side out, it's my chance to rock. The ball's coming to me, and you two are scorers. When you know it's your chance, your imagination is ready to execute. Yeah. Right? So now I got Chris wanting to play defense too. See what I'm saying? I got him his field goal attempt.
Yes.
Now he wants to play defense too. So now I took care of him. Now, how do I take care of everyone else, right? So you got to be – it's like you got to have moving parts. You got to remote control it. And that's how I think you really teach the game.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Hubie because and this guy predates you guys, but a guy named John Drew out of Gardner-Webb came in the league averaging 24, 25 a game. Hubie was his coach with the Hawks. The isolations and elbow stuff that he was running was ahead of his time. Bernard King – Hubie was his coach with the Knicks when he was dropping all those spectacular numbers back in
60 pieces
back in the mid 80s. But Hubie's known as a defensive guy, but he's a basketball coach, right, Earl? So he knows that one feeds into the other. you know, that you've got to keep these guys engaged offensively to have them give you at least a passable effort, if not more, at the defensive end.
Hey, Marcus, one thing I learned from UB2 that I always incorporate in my coaching is I never had private conversations. So when I took over Phoenix, I put everyone in. You could have Markieff Morris this. Wasn't playing, wasn't getting along with the staff, wanted to get traded, but we had 2 weeks to trade him, right? I had to create value. Hubie Brown. Put everyone in the theater. Went player by player, told them their role, their identity, how many shots they're going to get per game. Got to P.J. Tucker. P.J., you're going to be our leader on defense. You're going to get corner threes and layups only. Any corner three you don't shoot, I'm subbing you out. Right? Markieff, I know you don't want to be here. That's the NBA I was raised in, Marcus, the truth. I know you don't want to be here, but you are here. And while you are here, you are going to lead us in points per game, field goal attempts, rebounds, and I want your assist to go up because you're capable. And oh, by the way, you're a leader. So change your perspective. Devin Booker, you're the youngest in the room. You're going to shoot as much as Keith. I want y'all both to shoot between 16 and 23 shots a game. That's a lot of shots. And you're going to start, and you're the future of our franchise. Yeah. And the ball is going to be in your hands with Markieff at the end of every game. You're going to learn to grow. And you won't be successful, but I can't allow you to be. I can't take away failure, right, and ask you to be successful. You got to be willing to fail to grow. Oh, and by the way, anyone in the room got a problem with what I just said? No one has a problem?
Yeah.
Cool. Then I want to hear shit in the locker room. Then I got it from Ubi. I got it from Ubi. And then I go to Mirza Teletovic and John Lure. And I said, Mirza, the first 10 games, John Lure gets it. If he doesn't play well, you're taking his spot from the next 10. And whoever plays the best plays the rest of the season. And I want you both to shoot 10 to 15 threes per game. So now you put in expectations. Now people know his role. They know their role. They have identity. They understand it. And then you can just, whether you like it or not, you got to respect it. And you can move on from it.
Now, Earl, let's segue into the Milwaukee Bucks. They are a team that's built around specifically Giannis's talent, his skill base. Creating gravity, heliocentric, getting the ball, 38% usage rate. Now we got a bunch of catch and shoot guys. You take him out of that component, and you don't have guys that can create their own shots. You got, you know, KPJ can do it a little bit, Kyle Kuzma, Ryan Rollins maybe, but most of the guys are skill-based, centered around Giannis's strengths, right? You take Giannis out of there. So in terms of how you approach that as a coach, to keep everybody, keep their morale up, to keep them not to get too down by the losing and the disappointment and 2-10 and looking at that. I mean, how do you as a coach keep them playing hard? You know, playing hard is the key, as you mentioned. How do you keep them playing hard through all that?
Well, playing hard is a character, right? When you sign a player, you know if a player is going to play hard. That's the intel, and that's the homework you do before you sign a player on your roster. If you're surprised by a player not playing hard, you didn't do your homework. And the way the Spurs do their homework, they know your favorite food. They are detailed at their homework, really. Then you talk about the style of play, right? And this is, I can't take credit for this. But the style of play with Giannis, your team has to be vertical, right? Rim to rim, because it creates gravity. He's a downhill player. He wants to be a vertical. You want to be a vertical team. Right. If you are a horizontal team and the defense forces you to play horizontally, there's no gravity. There's just a shell. And we shell drill since we was in – I got my kids shell drill in the fourth grade, fifth grade, right? So you shell drill your entire life, right? So you go, okay, teams will have us playing horizontally. So what does that mean? How do we get back to playing vertically? We got to be what? Better be really good defensively.
Yeah.
And that don't mean lockdown defense. That means you have to get deflections, blocks, and steals, right? It may be We may have to throw out a 2-2-1, a 1-3-1, a box-and-one, a triangle and two. We have to be disruptive. Because if we are disruptive defensively, we create opportunities to play vertically again offensively in transition. Now, how do we change the rhythm and the momentum of the game? Because you can only hold it on for so long until we get some talent or a talented player that can help us play horizontally, right? Horizontal players are hard to come by. Those are your elite players who are just off the bounds with a lot of bop, a lot of wiggle that can create, you know, some horizontal movement, which is why Rollins is standing out so much in that offense. Because he's one of the players that can do all of that, get to the rim, get to the elbow, throw a lob from the elbow. Hezzy, step back, Chris. Hit the elbow, step back, attack the middle again. He's shifty, right? Which is why he's having major success.
And finally, this is the last one. So now, the Bucks, Earl, lead the league in zone defensive frequency. Like 14% of their possessions is zone defense right now. They just take it over. And you talked about being disruptive, mixing up defenses, playing this, playing that. In the NBA, can you get away with the zone as a primary defense?
Great question.
Yes, and if not, why not?
Hey Marcus, it's this donut place here called Lamar's Donuts. It is fire. They've been around since like 1901, right? It is so good. And sometimes it makes me feel good. Sunday morning, I get up. You know, especially when my AU teams are playing bad, so I'm going to Lamar's Sunday morning. But I cannot have Lamar's every Sunday. It is not sustainable. You cannot play that much zone defense. It's not sustainable. It's a Band-Aid, right? Zone defense is meant to say, hey, look, it's an ATO, right? I'm on the other side. That coaching staff over there would throw anything out there defensively. So when we're drawing up our plays, we need a foolproofer. So I'm going to limit the other team's playbook. So sometimes in the ATO, I might come out and have a 1-3-1. Okay. And on the third pass, we're matching into man-to-man. Hit the elbow, match into man-to-man. Now the game is not only between the players, between me and the other coaching staff. So you can't be so much, you can't rely on it to where it's an anchor, right? You got to rely on it to where it's a curveball.
More options. Okay, I got you. But look, man, I mean, Chris, you got anything else?
Man, nah, just...
this has been a...
I mean, you broke this down, Earl, like well, I knew you would.
Yeah, and that's why I say, you know, I mean, this young man needs to be a coach in this league at some point. You still coaching still in the horizons for you. I know you plan taking it day by day, but you still got that fire to be that passion to be a coach on the NBA level or college level.
Man, I think I've been a coach since I've been a point guard. So coaching is going to always be in me, right? And the one thing I realized with coaching is different from playing, from the playing side. As a player, you can go into any locker room and you can change it, right? I feel like as a player, I can change any locker room, right?
Correct.
I feel like I build a relationship, the coach would trust me. I can tell somebody in the huddle, switch. Chris, Hubie Brown gave me that leeway in my third or fourth year that Chris Paul didn't have. I don't know why Chris Paul don't have that leeway. I had it in Memphis.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know why. Something's wrong there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But I had that leeway. But in coaching, I believe the teaching is kind of like, let's bring back the teaching. Right. Yeah. I don't want to be a coach. I want to be a teacher.
Right.
Right. Let's bring back teaching. And if that environment is productive and teaching is available, I would love to coach again.
Yeah.
But I don't want to be there just to pass the ball.
Right.
And scream at a player. Play hard. What does that mean? What does that mean?
Yeah.
What does it mean? You got to teach the why. Hubie Brown always taught the why.
Yeah.
When he did TV, he said, and here's why. Here's the why.
Yeah.
The why allows everyone to grow and to understand and to be bought in. Without the why, Chris, players will question everything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And when you have a player questioning one thing and they don't know the why, you have lost your locker room. You lose your locker room, you lose the team. You got to have the why. So, yeah, if I can teach the why, Marcus, I'm in.
You mentioned Hubie. Give me like four or five other top coaches that really had an impact on you as a player and your philosophy. I know Hubie's up there. You know, could discuss them more and why.
Ron Adams.
Wow.
Great defensive coach.
Now, where were you? Where did you and Ron cross
from? OKC.
Okay.
Thunder.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Here's one for you that you'll love. Dick Harder.
Woo! Oregon. Yeah. Kamikaze kids, babe.
Tough. Yeah. He came up to me after our first exhibition game. All the training camp, and I had him with Jim O'Brien and the Pacers, Frank Vogel, Larry Bird, right? I've been around. I'm in basketball great around. I'm so blessed. Yeah. Training camp, he'd come up to me and always say little slick stuff. He'd be like, UCLA, and take off walking. Hey, I don't even know this dude.
That's Dick Harder.
Hey, I don't even know him, Marcus. And I'm quick to tell people where I'm from, right? So by like the fifth or sixth, I was like, hey, dog. I said, look, I don't know you. Watch how you talk to me. And he looked at me. Then he said, F*** you, and walked away. After the first exhibition game, he came up to me. He said, I love you. The way you play defense to get up under the ball. He started telling him about all his days in New York, right? With, Pat Riley, Oregon. And now we're talking Pac-12 history, Pac-10 history, John Wooden. He was like, he's just giving me all the love, and we became like this. So he would be third. And then I would say, Jerry Sloan.
Mm.
Jerry Sloan is a tough one.
Utah Jazz.
Utah, right? And when you have Jerry Sloan, you have great coaches with Jerry Sloan. And it's another one that no one really talks about that really impacted my life as a person. And that was Scottie Layden. Mm. Scott Layden was also an assistant in Utah, was front office with the Knicks.
Right.
The way he talked to me on how to be a man and how he reached into me for, making sure I was okay, like in my personal life, I'm forever grateful for him for that.
Yeah. Mm. That's a good list, man. Well, look, man, love your work on the Big Ten Network, FS1, what you're doing. I mean, you've always been to me someone who could break the game down and talk about basketball on a whole another kind of level. It's a ethereal kind of deeper level, and you belong in coaching at some point, and hopefully it comes sooner than later. But Earl Watson, man, we thank you for joining the Here District, man, and appreciate your time and energy, man, and your insights.